Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you again to the organizers for inviting me. And I have to say, sorry I missed yesterday. It was just poor planning on my part. I drove up last night from Pasadena. Pasadena is about 100 miles from here. And last night, when you come at 8 o'clock, it's easy. It took me about 100 minutes. But when as I was driving up, I remember about 15 years ago, I was coming up for a meeting here for the National Science Foundation, and I had funding from NSF, and I needed to be here. And I don't know if any of you in the room were at the same meeting, but it took me about 15 hours to get here. And it wasn't just traffic. It was that it had been raining, and there had been a slide, and the slide ran across Highway 1. And so I had to detour back a number of miles trying to find a hotel. Then the next morning, you hear the news that at least they had cleared one lane. And so then got in this very, very long line to go through one cleared lane. And I say it here because Southern California is beautiful. And I think Eckhart would agree. But there are other things that happen in Southern California that make it interesting. And so it seems appropriate to have slides and debris flows and to think about those kinds of things as we think about this meeting and what goes on here. So I've been working on some of these problems for some years, and I want to kind of give you an overview of the kinds of things that we've been doing. And so really what I've been very interested in is just kind of this question. It's not a new question at all, but just about the rheology, and rheology, especially as we think about more massive particles. And thinking about then shear flows where I've got a liquid and solid, and again, kind of the difference between this dilute suspension and what we think about dilute suspension. And here gamma, again, is just a shear rate. And when we think about granular flows, or what we envision for granular flows, where we think about then the stress is going with the square of the shear rate. And we've been interested in this transition and thinking about this transition. But before I go into what we do with rheology, I wanted to start by just showing you some of the things about particle collisions and what we've been looking at over the last, I don't know, 10 years, really, in terms of particle collisions, which then feeds back into what we're thinking about in terms of the rheology and some of the problems associated with the rheology. And so the simplest problems that we started doing, again, about 10 years ago, was just simple particle collisions in a liquid. Just think, I've got a particle coming towards a wall. There's a viscous fluid around it. I want to think about that rebound off of that wall and think about what that depends upon. And so what we think about then, or quantifying it, is just a coefficient of restitution, just rebound velocity over the impact velocity. And I'll show you some experiments, again, where we control the collision with a pendulum. Here, the parameter is Stokes' number. And here, I don't do it in terms of times, but just in terms of the measurable quantities. The impact velocity, the U here is the impact velocity. It's the velocity right before impact. And the density there, then, is the particle density. And so just this quick little movie here. There's just a little bit of dye in the wake. And so again, this is a fairly large particle coming in, hitting the wall. Again, the point of showing it again is just to remind you about the wake and the interaction of the wake as it comes in. For this particular collision, the rebound velocity was about 80% of the incoming velocity. Again, if it was in air, it would have been, I think it was about 95%, 96%. So some of the loss then, or the loss really is attributed to those hydrodynamic effects. And that's what we've been interested in thinking about. And so we ran a whole series of experiments, immersed collision with a simple pendulum here with the wall. But again, we also did some, and I'll show you just a little bit, where we also had one particle colliding into another particle. Again, we used a range of different materials, measured then the particle trajectory coming in, measure the particle trajectory coming out, and just with a high-speed camera so we have enough data points to resolve it. Again, different densities, same size particles. So we did this. This is against a wall. This is against two particles. Again, the issue with two particles is that you've got that mobility issue. So the particle can come in, and what we wanted to think about is also the fact that the particle can actually move during the collision. The second particle can actually move during the collision. And to then measure these coefficients of restitution. And so this was a grad student who spent many hours doing this graph. It is coefficient of restitution here. So here's a zero. So at the low end, so Stokes' numbers here is here. So at the low end, we actually see, and actually have many more data points we could have put over here. The particle comes in, you know, we can measure its velocity coming in, and it never goes out. It loses all of its energy during that collision process. So that Stokes number is less than about 10. The other end is Stokes numbers greater than about 2,000, we'd say. These are dry particles here, but these are not. These are in a viscous fluid. And so, you know, somewhere at 1,000, 2,000, we start seeing that the fact that there's this viscous fluid around that particle during that particle collision doesn't make any difference on the rebound. It comes in and it goes back out. And so it's between 10 and 2,000, we have this transition from no rebound to really a rebound in which it would look very similar to what it would be if that liquid was not surrounding that particle. In between, we've got a whole range of data points, and so we get something like this. Some of the data points, you'll say, God, there's a lot of scatter in it, and that's what drove my student crazy. I'd say, God, it looks like there's a lot of scatter. What are you doing? And he'd go back and do it again. The lot of scatter ones, like in here, are glass particles. The steel particles are the ones circled in red. And the difference, and we spent a lot of time doing this, the difference in those data sets was surface roughness. And so if you've got a lot of surface roughness and your particle's coming in, the collision spot is very, very small. You've got a lot of roughness. What we saw is more variability in that rebound velocity. And again, the smoother particles, such as the steel ball bearings here, if we thought about the kind of collision areas, that really, you know, it looks nice and smooth. And as we went to something like this, it was just more variable in what we saw in terms of the rebound velocity. And so we did just some various scaling in terms of that interaction and those length scales. And it seemed to make sense that my student wasn't just inefficient or not good at what he was doing, that there was these other effects that were probably coming into some of these experiments.
Surface charge is insignificant, or?
No. Not for these kinds of.
So
then we also did particle. We did actually both normal and oblique, and this is just the normal data. And the point here is just if we do a relative velocity when we do the normal collisions, again, we get the same trend here. Okay? We do have some funny things that kind of happened at lower Stokes where the particles, in some cases, kind of stick together. But these would be ones where we'd actually get a rebound, and for the most part, it looks similar to what we had with this particle wall. And we did it again for different combinations of materials. And then the last bit here I'm going to just show on the particles is that the student who is doing a lot of this, again, we are also just interested in cases. Again, when we did particle wall, the wall was really a very hard surface. So we're interested in doing cases in which the wall was not hard, where we had, and what we used was some ductile aluminum pieces. And then we had this impact rod here, a little sample here. It would come in and hit this. And then what we could do is go back and measure then the size of the craters. And we did this with different alloys of steel and different impactors. And again, this is just kind of the final results here. It looks something like this. So again, still coefficient to restitution versus Stokes number. And the size of these symbols have to do with the size of the crater. And so down at the lowest end, we could not measure any, at least with our measurement instrument, we did not measure any crater down here. And then you can see as we come up here, we start being able to measure a crater, and that the line, the data points then start deviating from this line. So this would be the line if it was just hydrodynamic losses. And these data points then show you what happens if we have some additional losses, really additional losses due to the fact that we have a deformable surface and that we have these material properties that come into play. And so what we're doing still, so the student actually graduated a couple years ago. I know some of my PhD students never finished their thesis, it seems, never finished writing up their thesis, and we're still working on finishing this up. But really trying to quantify the difference between the hydrodynamic losses and the loss that we get due to the indentation, and just trying to look then at both of those aspects in some of these problems.
Sorry, these impacts, they all have a fixed fall velocity, or
we this is over a whole range of fall velocities and a whole range of viscosities. So the surface starts out, we had many, many samples, perfectly smooth. We do one impact and then we measure the crater size and measure the rebound velocity. So it's a whole range of impact velocities, different viscosities, different particles. Okay. So that's what we're doing in terms of particle collisions. And so then what I want to do is go back to how this impacts what we think about in terms of rheology. And so again, this problem is not a new problem by any means. And here I just want to show a little bit about Bagnold and his rheometer. Again, I'm going to show you a series of rheometers here in a second. He used wax spheres, 1 millimeter diameter. We spent some time, again, quite a few years ago, now 10 years ago, really kind of looking at his experiment. The issue with his experiment and the design of the experiment is that he's got this liquid and solid within this annulus here. He's going to rotate the outer cylinder. And so as you rotate this whole outer can, again, this annulus is pretty small. The speeds that he operated it at, again, what you want to think about is I'm spinning this whole thing. I'm spinning this bottom plate here, this bottom plate here. The fluid along these bottom plates also wants to move outward. And so over the range that he did his experiments, these recirculation zones within his annulus were significant. And if you go back and try to think about his torque and his measured torque, if you account for this rotational flow, these secondary flows, you can really explain all of his experiments by just assuming you've got a suspension, so an effective viscosity. So really, in his experiments, though he says they're particle collisions, what we concluded through numerical simulations and really just analyzing his experiments is that it's the recirculation here that resulted in an increase in torque for the range of parameters that he looked at. It was not due to the collisions between these wax particles. And so in some of the things I'm going to show you in a little bit, the macroviscous were kind of low Reynolds number flows. And those measurements seem to be consistent with some of the things I'm going to show you. And so these low shear rate conditions that he looked at, that did not seem to be affected by the recirculation the way most of his high rotational speed data seem to be affected by it. So besides Bagnold, though, there are a series of other people who looked at these problems. Savage and McKean, again, early 80s. Again, here he's rotating the outer. Bagnold's rotating the outer. In this one, they're rotating the inner cylinder. Again, if you go back and just look at the kinds of rotational speeds that they were using, there's a critical Reynolds number. And now the critical Reynolds number here is actually very low. And it has to do with the fact that you're rotating the inner rather than rotating the outer. But the critical Reynolds number is very low. And so for the range that he was doing it, there must have been, for this kind of Reynolds number, also recirculating zones within this annulus, and significant probably for the range of Reynolds numbers that he was running it at. Dan is here. And I got to hesitate talking about Dan's work here with him here. And he's going to correct me if I say something wrong. Again, it was glass beads in water. Here, the rheometer is designed, though, so that the shear is 90 degrees to the other two experiments I just showed you before. So the issues with the rotational effects are not as significant because the way he's measuring the torque and the way the torque is measured here is not in the same plane as the earlier rheometers that I just showed you. And here, again, I think with the glass beads and water, again, one of the things that they talk about in the paper is that the heavy particles tended to settle, and that for some of the cases they looked at, there's only partial shearing of the flow. Acrophos, again, Acrophos has done many rheometer experiments. The one I want to show you here is things during the 90s, and I'll come back to this in a few minutes. Most of what they were looking at were neutrally buoyant experiments. Again, the particles are very small. They wanted to just do these measurements, really low Reynolds numbers, neutrally buoyant. But again, some of the effects of the density difference between the particles and the fluid became important. And again, I'll show you some of those results because they impact what we're doing in just a few minutes. For Poseidon-Kytoma, again, similar to the Haynes and Inman, where again, the torque is measured from the top plane. Again, there are some issues with the non-mutually buoyant particles. These were for somewhat larger particles, 3 millimeter acrylic spheres. And then the more recent things, Boyer, Gozelli, and Pulikin. Again, a small rheometer, again, shearing from the top. Again, here the particles, 1 millimeter, and then some submillimeter particles. And so if we look at, let me just come back to this in a second. What I'm interested then is kind of thinking about these experiments, thinking about our experiments. And I'll show you our rheometer in just a second. But for the most part, many of the, there's many more experiments that are low Reynolds number experiments. But these really are low Reynolds number experiments. Haynes and Inman, again, it's somewhat much higher Reynolds numbers. Posada, higher Reynolds numbers. And the Bagnold-Macroviscus, again, higher Reynolds numbers. So the Reynolds number that I'm using here is a Reynolds number based on shear rate, and that's particle diameter. And here, then, it's solid fraction. And our work, what we've been very interested in then, is kind of pushing the limits at the higher end, okay? So high Reynolds number flows, and really thinking about what we get from these high Reynolds number flows over a wide range of solid fractions. And the way we designed our experiments, and again, we've been working on this also for years, this darn thing, again, it's large. And it's designed so that, again, our fluid and particles are here within the annulus. And what we wanted to do is, again, whenever we've got this spinning, rotating piece and this stationary piece, you're always going to get some recirculation. You can't avoid it with the rotation in the fixed piece. But what we did was we measure our torque then in the center. And so this blue piece right here in the center, it's actually, there's a tiny gap right here all through the annulus. And so this piece here, we can directly measure the torque from using a kind of a spring system. But it allows us then to measure the torque in the middle of the annulus in a region that's away from the corner. And that's why we designed it. The challenge, of course, is that we've got a small gap here, and we've got particles. And it's a headache. I'll just tell you, it's a headache. And it's been part of the problems with the whole design is the challenge of this torque measurement. Again, we've got some optical probes above and below where we can do some measurements as well. But the whole idea is to measure the torque in a range, in a region that's away from the ends. And so when we first have been doing these, let me just show you this first. This is just pure fluid. So laminar flow, smooth walls. And here I just want to show you that we can measure a laminar flow in this annulus. Again, here in this particular set of experiments, the Reynolds number is up to about 3,700. For our geometry, again, because we're spinning the outer, we're still going to get secondary flows at some point. But the secondary flows right now, it's about 15,000. But I'll come back to this, too, because that is something we want to think about. Again, at some point, you're going to get it. And we just want to be aware of when we're going to get it. Again, if I just use pure fluid results, it's around 15,000. So we did started out by doing a whole series of experiments with neutrally buoyant particles, or about neutrally buoyant particles. And so this is non-dimensional torque. So we just do our measured torque divided by our torque if it was a pure fluid, and we could just use that kind of use a pure fluid result for our geometry. And so this then becomes really an effective viscosity as a function of Stokes' number. And what you see here is that this is the lowest solid fraction going up to the highest solid fraction. And what you see is these measurements are independent of Stokes. So they depend upon the solid fraction. And in the range we're in, again, it's independent of the Stokes. Okay. What I should say, again, is though in doing this here, we've divided by a shear rate. As we take our measurements, again, divide by a shear rate when we do that non-dimensionalization. There are a couple experiments here where the densities are slightly mismatched. And it's these experiments here. And so the density difference is less than 1%, but we actually see it here. And this has still been one of our challenges, is getting an accurate measurement of the solid fraction. So we know what we fill the system with. We've got two probes where we can measure top and bottom. But differences in solid fraction on the order of 1%, we're not very good at measuring. And so we see some slight difference, probably due to settling when there's a slight mismatch in the densities. And I should say, this is for some polystyrene, 3-millimeter polystyrene particles. We did it for three different types of particles. So nylon spheres, another plastic, and then polystyrene. Again, what's plotted here is just the effective viscosity versus the viscosity of the fluid that we used. This is then a solid fraction normalized by a loose pack solid fraction. And again, the student that was doing this work, Aaron Coos, felt it went better this way in terms of the plotting. These are our experiments here then. Again, this is for smooth walls. And then these are the Bagnell, just his macroviscous data here are these points here. And again, the macroviscous is where we think the secondary flows weren't affected. And so this is, looks typical compared to other kind of suspension problems where you get a very high effective viscosity as the solid fraction increases.
Can you comment briefly on why the packing fraction should be, the loose packing fraction should be different from the different fraction?
They're different shapes. You know, they're different shapes. They're not, this most spherical ones are the nylon. These are more of a, sorry, these are almost more of a cylinder, and these are, they're not all round.
But how can you measure that? How can you measure the loose pack?
You know, we had a container about the same dimensions of what our annulus was, and she measured how much she put in, measured, shook it, measured it.
After tapping or before?
No, so this was these were all measured before they were put into the.
By settling.
Okay. So if this is smooth walls. And so one of the things then for smooth walls, again, we wanted to kind of go back to and see, is if I do it now, just effective viscosity, and now here the Reynolds number is the same kind of Reynolds number you'd think about if you thought about secondary flows. So it's a Reynolds number based upon the gap here. So again, any kind of rotational flow would use this kind of Reynolds number. And so this is just our measurement divided by an average. And so what we see is, you know, most of these right are about one. Again, we've got some variation in our measurements. Here you start seeing things going up. And so again, the question then is, you know, at high enough Reynolds numbers, are we starting to see something else? And the caution here is that at about this Reynolds number where we start seeing an increase with Reynolds number, this Reynolds number here of about 10,000 is very close to the critical Reynolds number that you get for this geometry. And so it's somewhere in this range. We're going to start expecting that we're going to get in some secondary flows. And that is where this is. And so it's kind of very inconclusive if we're really seeing anything different or not based upon these measurements here. We also, again, what I've showed you so far is for smooth walls. We also did some similar things with rough walls and some more limited measurements with rough walls. What's interesting is the rough wall data, the rough wall torques are larger than what we had for the smooth walls. And then the other piece of this here, too, is that this line here is a correlation for suspensions. And so this is a correlation for low Reynolds number suspensions. And it certainly fits the data by Akervas that I mentioned before, the data by Boyer. And so for these higher Reynolds number flows, we are getting effective viscosities both for the smooth and for the rough walls that are higher than what you get at low Reynolds numbers, okay, and quite a bit higher. The other couple data points that I have on here are the two from Dan Haynes, where we try to use Dan's data and get an effective viscosity out of it. The Prasad and Kaitoma are these points here. Again, in that paper, they do show effective viscosities for some of their data. And so again, comparing these data points, again, it's higher solid fractions. But here, kind of the point is that for both rough and smooth, it's quite a bit higher than what we'd expect for the low Reynolds number suspensions. The difference between the rough and smooth, we went back, and I'm not going to show you the details right here, but certainly for these high shear rates with smooth walls, you get slip along the surface. And so if we go back and do some analysis of a slip layer, we can really reconcile the difference between our measured torques for the rough and smooth if we account for the fact that we probably have some slip for the smooth-walled cases. But the main point I want to just emphasize is that, again, this effective viscosity is higher than what we got for low Reynolds number suspensions. And then that's one issue. And then the second issue is, why don't we transition to something that we might think about in terms of a granular flow, a rheology in which the torques are dependent on the shear rate to a higher power than one, is really the question. Why aren't we still getting it? And the possible answer here that we keep coming back to has to do with what I showed you at first, that our local Stokes numbers still not high enough, so that if our Stokes numbers aren't high enough, we may not be getting real collisions between the particles. And so if I take the map that I showed you earlier, again, solid fraction, and now instead of a Reynolds number, use a Stokes number, our Stokes numbers over the range that we were doing it were less than 100, okay? And so less than 100, we're starting to get collisions, but the collisions are not strong. We get a lot of dissipation in that collision for those kinds of Stokes numbers. And so our previous work was up here in terms of Stokes. What we're trying to push right now, and the student is working on, hopefully today as I talk to you about it, pushing it to higher Stokes numbers. And so the way we're trying to do that is to increase the density slightly, decrease the viscosity, and kind of push the experiment to a higher Stokes number. And so, but before I show you that, so again, the fluids that we're using, it's really water and water glycerin. And so we've been adjusting the amount of glycerin to match the densities, get the density right. As we drop the viscosity by dropping a little bit of the glycerin in our mixtures, again, then we have a density mismatch between the particles and the fluid. And that becomes an issue. And so this was, again, a plot from Akervos's work in 1994. They did not design their experiment to look at mismatched densities, but they realized as they were doing the experiment that it was important. And so what you'd find in the annulus like this is that there's a region towards the bottom where there's just a higher solid fraction. And so as he measured an effective viscosity, and here this is his parameter A, but A is, again, similar to something you think about in terms of a Shields number, that as A gets larger, you're able to disperse the particles through that annulus, you get less settling. And so his experiments show that, again, as you increase A, you've got this what looks like shear thinning, but it's not really shear thinning because it just really has to do with the fact that you've got settling at the bottom. And so you reach a point where your effective viscosity seems to flatten out. And that where it flattens out, again, depends upon the solid fraction that you're at. But he also had these predictive lines here, and the predictive lines really, it's a balance of at low Reynolds numbers settling, and then shear-induced migration due to the fact that you're shearing this. So this is what he had. And so when we start doing mismatches of density, we see the same kind of thing. So now it's Stokes number here again. Same kind of thing here for effective viscosities. This set of experiments is density difference of about 5%. And so you see, again, as we do it, we come down and we kind of flatten out. And so here, we think this is, you know, the shear rate's not high enough and we're getting settling. At the bottom, we're seeing something different where it's coming up. Where it's coming up, it has to do with the design of our rheometer, that we're measuring the torque in the middle of that cylinder. And so if things are settling down, it may not be high enough to get the region where we're actually measuring the torque. And so we have two things kind of going on. For the lowest is that our rheometer design is preventing us, I think, to measure some of this stuff down here. And that, again, if we're not shearing high enough, we're getting the settling effect. So the student's kind of working on things to kind of change the rheometer slightly so we can make measurements down here. But what we're then looking at then is what happens as this flattens out. And what happens here, these lines are here just actually drawn as an average. But what you're starting to see is that there does seem to be some increase at some point. And now this is Stokes numbers over 100. And so if we do, this is the blue is the settling data, the slight mismatch in densities, black is the neutrally buoyant. You start seeing, again, these guys coming down, but they flatten out. They seem to be consistent with what we did here. And so what the student is working on right now is still pushing it a little bit farther and trying to get some better measurements of the overall solid fraction. So again, here, we think this is the same solid fraction here and here, and there may be differences somewhat in terms of the settling, but you start seeing it's sure looking like it's starting to increase. And again, it's increasing at Stokes numbers, again, somewhat over 100. And this is just the last result I'm going to show you here, and then I'll stop. This, again, is because our annulus isn't big enough. This, again, are settling kinds of things. So this is effective Reynolds number, thinking about these secondary flows. What's interesting here is that we see these increases seem to come at different solid fractions. So this, to me, at least, is suggesting that maybe this increase is not because of secondary flows. Maybe we're getting to the point where we're starting to actually getting some collisions between the particles, because it's not all happening at one Reynolds numbers. It's happening at different solid fractions. And so we're going to push it a little bit further, do slightly denser particles, slightly less viscous fluids, and see if we can push it out a little bit more and see what we get. And so really, our prior experiments that we published so far is all Stokes numbers less than 80. And so if I come back to this coefficient restitution versus Stokes number, we're down here. And so it may be that, again, when the collisions are not strong, we still may be able to represent it with an effective viscosity. And of course, what we'd love to be able to do is push it out here. And so given our rheometer and what we can do with it, you know, that's what we're still working on. And so this is what the student is working on right now, denser particles and then more accurate measurements of the solid fraction. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What would go wrong if you were to turn your rheometer by 90 degrees and rotate it like this?
We could certainly try it. This thing is big, it's heavy, it's finicky. The building that I'm in, it was built in the 40s, hasn't been renovated in 70 years, except it's planned to be renovated starting in about 3 months. And so right now what I'm trying to get to do is we've got this very hard demo. If we have to move this thing and set it up again, it's going to be will be a disaster. So there's lots of things I think we could still do and other kind of interesting things. Right now I want her to do everything she can before they throw us out of the building. So it's something that we thought about. Again, I think it would be interesting to try it. Yeah, it'd be interesting to try it and see and what kinds of things we might get different. How much settling we get, and we'd be able to see if I'm doing something like that. But this thing is big and heavy, and this huge motor in the end, it's not easy to do.
Yeah, maybe I haven't looked hard enough, but recently I've been trying to work out about coefficients of restitution. And I noticed that you use quite a simple just ratio of velocity R to velocity N. But my confusion was over whether or not, if you have a wetted collision, should it be a ratio of energies or should it be a ratio of momentum?
So, again, we've looked at different ways of doing it, just the velocity in, velocity out. Even when you have binary collisions with different masses, it works great. But there is, you know, there's an energy analysis that goes with coming up with velocity in, velocity out. But that is the best way to show our data. The key is always making the velocity coming in being right next to the wall. Because in some collisions, especially when you go to low Stokes numbers, they're losing their velocity as they come in. So you want to make the velocity measurement of the impact velocity just before it hits that surface. And then we're able to explain our results. We tried different things as
well. So is mass then not important?
Why is mass not important? Even when we did... Now again, I had a student that spent a lot of time doing it when she was doing the binary collisions. And you know, we tried various things because we thought it was going to be important. We did some things actually with mismatched particles. So you can see steel glass here, glass steel, steel Delrin. So there are mismatched densities here. And we tried different things when we were presenting the data and came back the best way to present it was this way.
So then what is the coefficient restitution?
The coefficient restitution, it's the relative velocities coming in between the particles, the numerator is relative velocities going out divided by relative velocities coming in. And we tried all kinds of different things, and going back to this, brought all the data together.
Interesting.
Yep. I have a question concerning the title of the conference a little bit, because it's about particle laden flows in nature. I'm a little bit lost with the Stokes numbers. Where are we with the flows in nature, with those kinds of Stokes numbers, or just in this diagram?
Well, these particles, so this steel, you put it on steel. Right, the glass is pretty similar to what you have for sand, for grains. Again, here, most of our particles were probably from 2 millimeters up to 6 millimeters. So you could, you know, certainly cover for those kinds of diameters, same kinds of Stokes number ranges.
And in the terms of flow regimes or something like this, does it make sense to talk about it?
Maybe the velocities, the relative velocities, what's the order of magnitude of that?
The relative velocity, you know, again, this is just a simple pendulum, so it's, you know, centimeters a second kinds of numbers in terms of the speeds of these particles when we're doing it. So again, some of these were very viscous fluids, you know, release this particle, it's maybe 10 centimeters or certain kinds of speeds that we do something sometimes slower than that.
I could just say in bed load transport and water, per particle was about 1 centimeter. You calculated like near the threshold of motion, like a shield stress near entrainment of the particle would be about 100 for the Stokes center. So it's in the same regime.
Just sort of basic question. Maybe it's the first part of your talk. Okay. So supposing you have two particles, and so you have glass, steel, delving. So let's imagine they're more squishy. I don't want to use the word elastic.
Yeah.
It's kind of elastic. Squishier. So if you make it more squishier, and if you collide enough fluid, does it rebound more or less? Because you know. It's infinitely hard in a viscous fluid and infinitely smooth, it should just come to rest. It should be every collision should be completely inelastic. So there's a lubrication. So my understanding is the reason why anything rebounds is because these particles squish.
Well, and right, because you've got some storage during, absolutely. Right, there's some energy storage during the collision process.
Right, right.
And that energy storage then is released in the rebound. And that's why we get back here to one, approximately one. Again, here you can see we did nylon delving here against steel glass. A lot of them were steel and glass. You know, there's a kind of a range of material properties here. It didn't really seem to make any difference. Again, when we did make a difference is when we went to something soft, which is what we did here, where there's really soft aluminum particles.
So if you made it something like PMMA or rubber, for example, which is 1,000 times softer.
Yeah. Again, we didn't.
Would you see a trend?
We didn't try, we could have. You know, again, if we do coefficient restitution dry for the nylon Delrin, you know, coefficient restitution is probably about 0.92, 0.93, something like that. So again, you're still getting in a dry case pretty good rebounds, but we didn't try anything that was 0.7, 0.96. We didn't try anything quite like that.
Two questions. One is, if you did these impact experiments in a very confined setting, so that the fluid does not have anywhere to go, how would the coefficient of restitution be then?
We think, again, we do this whole thing with visualization of wake, all that kind of stuff. We don't think that makes any difference. What really makes a difference is just that pushing the fluid out during that impact period, and then the fluid filling back in as the rebound happens, that it's all this lubrication process. That much of this, again, we've also spent some time trying to do some modeling, much of it is just this lubrication process during that collision phase. And that's why, again, we think about the areas that are impacted, that's why, again, some of this surface roughness comes into play, because it's this impact in this impact area that is so important in determining that process.
Well, that means I could safely use your experimental values to calculate in a calculation where I have a high density of particles.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. And again, there are people who have done some things with just a thin film and an impact of a particle on a thin film of fluid, and it's pretty similar to the kinds of things that we see here.
Okay, my second question would be, in the case of these deforming, or the impact of hard particles on soft walls, if you calculate basically the plastic energy, the dissipation in the solid, uh-huh. in the wall, and does this add up? Can you then basically use the coefficient of restitution?
This is exactly what we're trying to do here, try to add up the energies. And what we really think is that you could do the plasticity, do the impact, forget about the fluid as you do that impact, and just think about what's happening during that deformation process. Add that energy to what we think our kinetic energy is coming in, and you should get back to that curve. And that's actually what we're doing right now. And so really, when we look at the craters dry and wet for the same impact velocity, the crater size looks independent of whether we had a fluid in there or not. And then when we go back and do the energy calculations, it seems to not matter. That we can take the solid part, add it to the fluid part, get back to our total energy of our system.
How is the velocity scale in your in the Stokes number for uh-huh. your rheometer defined?
So we did, you know, I did different ways, and again, most of these down here. it's the shear rate times the particle diameter is what we're using. Right. So again, if you want to think about relative velocities, what you think about is a shear rate and that distance between the particle, which is related.
So in the other scope, there was no square on the grain size, is that right?
Yes, it is square on the grain size. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Square on the size. And sorry, I had it up there earlier, bigger, but this is what we're doing. And then some of the ones where I'm thinking about the secondary flows, again, we go back to the definition that people use when they do secondary flows, which is gap and then the rotational speed.
I have a question about the soft targets.
Uh-huh.
So the size of the craters that you show, if I understand this, correctly, are a submicrometer.
Yeah.
And so this highlights kind of the idea that the impact has nothing to do with the curvature of the object, but it's really the local roughness.
Yeah.
Kind of the same thing that you saw in the glass.
Yes.
And the nylon.
Yeah, we took great pains to make this really, really smooth, just boom, as smooth as we could before we hit it, and then take the profilometer and go down through and measure it.
So that probably makes the quantification of this plastic energy that Peter was referring to extremely difficult, because you're dealing with tolerances of the order of hundreds of nanometers.
Yes, it absolutely is. But again, when we do just even kind of things out of the literature in terms of trying to quantify it, we seem to be pretty good actually quantifying that loss, and quantifying what kind of impact we should get, what kind of crater we should get.
Right.
Is there a time variation in your craters? I mean, when you impact it, does the material, I don't know about this material, does it kind of produce a maximum depth of crater and then kind of back out a little bit?
No, we hit it, we take a we measure
right,
it.
Right.
Yeah. There's no we can't do it as it's happening. We don't have a way to do it as it's happening. Yeah. So we make it really smooth, hit it, measure.
Yeah, I'm still, I guess, a bit confused in terms of the stuff around the surface roughness or the glass beads.
Uh-huh.
I mean, is that really just an effect that because it's rough, the fluid flow profile at impact ends up being different, or is it that the sort of the effective, direction of the forces ends up being changed versus, maybe if, something like the glass bead deforms itself if it's rougher?
Well, again, probably those things do happen. So again, what's happening here is this is a measurement of surface roughness. This is a calculation. It's a calculation based upon Davis's work, where they calculated for elastic materials what is the minimum distance of approach a particle would make on a perfectly smooth surface, perfectly smooth particle, perfectly smooth surface, elastic materials, how close does it actually get? And so you can do this calculation here. We can measure this roughness here. And so you can see as we go to steel, these two quantities are of the same order. And that's where we didn't see much difference variation in the rebound. On this other calculation here is a calculation of how big an area we have during the impact. And this is calculation versus the measurement of the distance between asperities. So this gives us some idea about how big an impact we hit, or how big an area we hit. And so with the steel, you see, there are different things happening in the steel surface. So we're hitting a couple variations in this surface. But that the overall roughness is small compared to this distance. And when we go up here, again, you've got to imagine that it's hitting, and it's probably hitting a couple of asperities as it comes in, but these things are big compared to this minimum distance. And so you may get some deformation then of the surface features during that process. And then what we overall see is variation in the rebound velocity.
And so you think it's because of deformation of the asperities, not just the fact that the fluid flow will be more complicated because of that, or you don't know?
Well, I'll tell you why we don't know. We look at this, we look at our measurements, we say this seems to give us much more, less repeatable results. All those other things, we don't have a way of really determining it. But certainly this is much more complicated kind of flow, if you think about it, those kind of length scales. Yeah.
Just a comment. We found out that surface roughness even matters for dry conditions. It makes a lot of difference if you use nylon or glass beads or whatever. The surface roughness determines a lot.
On dry alone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Being dry.
Okay. And with that, we will turn the speaker again. And while I'm
transition for the computers. I'll introduce the last speaker of this morning, Dr. Matthew Wells from the University of Toronto. And he's going to talk us about the influence of Coriolis forces on the position and erosion pattern in the gravity current.